Good afternoon. The Subcommittee on the Federal Workforce, Postal Service, and the District of Columbia hearing will now come to order. And I want to welcome our ranking member, Mr. Chaffetz of Utah, members of the Subcommittee, hearing witnesses, and all those in attendance. As you may know, the purpose of today's hearing is to examine the status of federal agencies' occupational safety and health protocols that are responsible for protecting federal workers from communicable diseases, such as the H1N1 virus, also known as the swine flu. The chair, ranking member, and subcommittee members will each have 5 minutes to make opening statements, and all members will have 3 days within which to submit statements for the record. At this time, I would like to ask unanimous consent for the testimony of our chairman, Benny Thompson of the Homeland Security Committee, to be entered into the record. Hearing no objections, it is so ordered. I'll take a moment before we introduce the first panel just to make a brief introductory statement. In the wake of the H1N1 flu outbreak, we hope it's the wake, this afternoon's hearing has been convened to examine and discuss current federal worker safety protections and policies. As chair of the Federal Workforce Subcommittee, it is my responsibility to ensure the health and safety of our federal employees, especially frontline federal workers who are tasked with the awesome job of keeping the American public safe and healthy. While we've all seen the headlines and have read various reports on H1N1 or swine flu cases, today's hearing is especially intended to review existing policies at key federal agencies relating to employee precautionary behavior and the use of PPE, personal protective equipment. Entitled Protecting the Protectors, an Assessment of Frontline Federal Workers in Response to the H1N1 Outbreak, today's proceedings will provide our agency witnesses an opportunity to elaborate on their own respective responses to the H1N1 virus outbreak. Today's hearing also affords us the chance to enter into a dialogue about the implementation of future policies that would govern and lay out the rights of frontline workers to access and don protective gear during a time of potential crisis. This is especially noteworthy since most of our medical experts expressed the opinion that next fall we could see a resurgence or an echo of sorts of the H1N1 virus, but in a more lethal form, be it the result of a public health emergency or a man-made disaster. Since 9/11, our country as a whole has awakened to the need for ongoing emergency preparedness. Subsequently, federal agencies have been charged with drawing up a variety of disaster scenarios so that our government can respond effectively and swiftly in time of crisis. However, all one has to do is recall the horrific events following Hurricane Katrina on the Gulf Coast to be reminded that much work in the area of emergency preparedness and continuity of government remains to be done. In addition to the work needed to ensure the public safety, it is essential that agencies implement adequate and uniform worker protection policies for the employees who protect the nation as part of their daily duties. Amidst the general emergency response, planning efforts undertaken by agencies to safeguard the public, sufficient time must be devoted to develop and execute sensible policies aimed at securing the health and safety of the very employees who will be called upon to respond in the event of an emergency. Without such policies, not only is the health of frontline workers being put at risk, but the health of their families and the communities in which they live and the general welfare of the public is also placed at risk. In short, the federal government cannot ably respond to emergencies if the very personnel needed as part of that response are themselves compromised. Frontline federal workers, their families, the communities where they reside and where their kids go to school deserve to be reassured that their employer, the federal government, which in this case we are responsible for, has done everything possible to guarantee their protection while on the job. I'd like to thank the witnesses in advance for their willingness to appear and testify as we take a hard look into what is being done and what is not being done to keep our frontline federal workers safe. This concludes my opening statement, and I now yield to our ranking member, Mr. Chaffetz.
Thank you, Chairman Lynch, for holding this important hearing on protecting the protectors and an assessment of frontline federal workers in response to the swine flu, H1N1, outbreak. I also want to thank the witnesses for taking time out of their busy schedules to testify before the subcommittee, and appreciate your understanding and flexibility given the series of votes that we need to participate in. We do appreciate your time and your attention, your being prepared for this, and want to thank you so much for your participation. As federal workers across all sectors have been involved in the response to the medical emergency, it is crucial that the proper protocols are in place to protect these workers. The health of Americans depends on a healthy federal workforce. I hope our witnesses can give us insight into the current response to the H1N1 epidemic and help us assess where we have succeeded and where we have failed. As a result of the threats from SARS and avian influenza, former President George W. Bush issued the National Strategy for Pandemic Influenza on November 1, 2005. The strategy guides the nation's readiness and response to flu pandemics and has given direction to the federal, state, and local governments on how to respond in the wake of the current H1N1 flu outbreak. A key part of the strategy, quote, is to sustain infrastructure in mitigating impact to the economy and the functioning of society, end quote. It's exactly what we're here to talk about today. Although a pandemic cannot damage physical infrastructure such as roads and power lines the way other catastrophic events might, it can cripple an organization through impact on the organization's human resources and prevent it from completing its essential functions. When that organization is the federal government, the consequences can be dire. Planning for the protection of federal workers from illness and also for continuity of operations should a large enough of employees get sick is essential. A strong federal response to a pandemic is a key to mitigating the severity of the illness and loss of life, and for the easing of potential devastating effects that an outbreak or a pandemic flu can have on our nation's economy. Personnel policies must reflect the twofold goal of keeping our federal workers healthy and therein ensuring continuity of operations. Providing protective gear, updating telework and other social distancing policies, and implementing health information technology are valuable parts of the pandemic flu strategy. These tools allow federal agencies to continue their important roles in responding to an emergency. Recently, it was brought to my attention that the Department of Homeland Security, while issuing written guidance to protect its employees, is not, in fact, executing the guidelines on the front lines. Managers, I am told, are prohibiting Customs and Border Protection officers from wearing protective masks. Since our borders provide an opportunity to slow the spread of H1N1, we must ensure the health of our first-line defense, the Border Patrol agents, Transportation Safety Administration officials, and other law enforcement and healthcare professionals. Disturbed by this contradictory message from Department of Homeland Security, I, along with 19 of my colleagues, sent a letter to Secretary Janet Napolitano demanding immediate revocation of the prohibition on masks. Mr. Chairman, I'd ask unanimous consent to submit the letter sent to President Obama and Secretary Napolitano into the record.
Without objection. So ordered.
Thank you. It is a delicate balance that we must strike between protecting our frontline employees and not causing mass public fear and alarm. I hope our witnesses can provide some answers as we look into the effect of this epidemic is having in our federal workforce. Again, I thank you for your participation and look forward to hearing from you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Chair now recognizes the gentleman from Virginia, Mr. Connolly, for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I want to thank you for holding this important subcommittee hearing. We must seize this opportunity to explore steps that we can take to protect the nation from this or future pandemics. 90 years ago, an influenza epidemic swept the world, starting here in the United States, killing approximately 50 million people. Today, enhanced mobility means that other pandemics could spread even more quickly and more broadly. Federal, state, and local governments have made significant investments in emergency preparedness since September 11th. In my district, Fairfax County opened a state-of-the-art emergency operations center. Regionally, the Metropolitan Washington Council of Governments, whose Emergency Preparedness Council I chaired until being elected to this job, has coordinated cross-jurisdictional emergency response planning with the goal of enhancing interoperability. The state of Virginia has pursued similar efforts. While those efforts have positioned us to respond to emergencies more effectively, we've focused more on response to a variety of attacks, perhaps, than events such as a pandemic. Since many levels of government have made substantial investments in both physical infrastructure and personnel for emergency preparedness, we must be able to identify efficient ways in which to ensure these existing facilities and networks can address both pandemics as well as terrorism. In addition to preparing our response to such pandemics, we need to take all possible steps to reduce the likelihood that they can occur. I'm concerned, for example, that the widespread use of antibiotics in factory farms could be creating supergerms that would be resistant to medication we use in humans. While we do not know if there's any link between the use of antibiotics in factory farms and the swine flu, it is a timely reminder that our stock of antibiotics is a finite resource that we need to guard closely. I believe the Preservation of Antibiotics for Medical Treatment Act, introduced by our colleague Representative Slaughter of New York, represents a thoughtful approach to protecting the potency of our antibiotics. Finally, Mr. Chairman, as the hearing brief made apparent, we need to take aggressive steps to protect our transit security employees from pandemics. It's unconscionable that TSA or Border Patrol or Customs employees are not permitted to wear respiratory masks while interacting with thousands of travelers as a precaution to prevent the spread of diseases. I expect both agency witnesses and representatives of employee unions to tell this committee how we can rectify that problem immediately. I thank you again, Mr. Chairman, for holding these timely hearings.
Thank you. It is the custom of this committee to swear witnesses for testimony. Would you please rise and raise your right hand? Would you repeat after me? Would you respond to this? Do you solemnly swear that the testimony you will give before the subcommittee is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? Let the record show that each of the witnesses has answered in the affirmative. Before I ask for testimony, we'll do a brief introduction of the witnesses. Panel one, Mr. Thomas Galassi is Director, Technical Support and Emergency Management, Occupational Safety and Health Administration. Mr. Galassi is the Director of OSHA and the Director of the Technical Support and Emergency Management, where he is responsible for the emergency preparedness, response activities, and workplace safety and health guidance. As a certified industrial hygienist, Mr. Galassi serves as Deputy Director of the Directorate of Enforcement Programs, where he had oversight of federal agency safety and health from 1999 to 2008. Dr. David Weissman is the Director of the Division of Respiratory Disease Studies of the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health and holds board certifications in internal medicine, allergy and immunology, and pulmonary diseases. He has authored and co-authored more than 60 publications, primarily in the area of lung immunology, tuberculosis, and occupational lung disease. Ms. Nancy Kishak was named Associate Director of the Human Resources Policy Division at the U.S. Office of Personnel Management in September 2005. In this position, she leads the design, development, and implementation of innovative, flexible, merit-based HR policies. In 2003, Ms. Kishak was awarded the Presidential Rank Award of Distinguished Executive for extraordinary accomplishments in the management of government programs. Ms. Elaine Duke was confirmed as the Department of Homeland Security Undersecretary for Management on June 27, 2008. Ms. Duke is responsible for the management and administration of the department, which includes directing the human capital resources and personnel programs for DHS's 216,000 employees. Additionally, she oversees the department's $47 billion budget, appropriations, expenditures of funds, accounting, and finance. Welcome. Mr. Galassi, you have 5 minutes. Just as a general guideline, that box in front of you will keep track of your time. You have 5 minutes to summarize your written statement that has already been entered into the record. When the light turns yellow, you should probably sum up, and when the light turns red, your time has expired. Okay, Mr. Galassi, welcome.
Chairman Lynch, Ranking Member Chavez, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to discuss the Occupational Safety and Health Administration's strategy for the protection of America's federal workers from the new strain of influenza A 2009 H1N1 virus. Before I begin my testimony, I want to express my gratitude for the many federal workers who have responded so quickly to the current outbreak. It is clear that federal agencies must be prepared for public health emergencies so that the federal workplaces are not disrupted and the delivery of essential programs and services are not adversely affected. The full range of OSHA's training, education, technical assistance, enforcement, and public outreach programs will be used to help protect federal workforce. Preparation is critical. OSHA has been engaged in efforts associated with the National Strategy for Pandemic Influenza, which directs all federal departments and agencies to plan, prepare for a possible influenza pandemic. To support that effort, OSHA has published two guidance documents to help all employers, including federal employers, better protect their employees and lessen the impact of a pandemic on society and the economy. Our guidance on preparing workplaces for an influenza pandemic includes an occupational risk pyramid for pandemic influenza to help employers select for their employees appropriate administrative work practice, engineering controls, and personal protective equipment based on exposure risk associated with specific tasks. OSHA's current outreach efforts are aimed primarily at high-risk and very high-risk workers, those who have direct contact with infected individuals as part of their job responsibilities, such as healthcare workers and first responders. OSHA recognizes the importance of protecting healthcare workers, like those working at the Veterans Affairs, on whom this country will rely to identify, treat, and care for individuals with the flu. OSHA has issued pandemic influenza preparedness and response guidance for healthcare workers and employers, which provides valuable information and tools about healthcare facility responsibilities during pandemic alert periods. OSHA is also developing guidance for employers on how to determine the need to stockpile respirators and face masks, along with fact sheets, quick cards, written in English and in Spanish. The agency's website, www.osha.gov, contains comprehensive information dealing with a pandemic, as well as a link to the federal website at www.panflu.gov. Federal agency heads play a central role in protecting their employees' safety and health. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration has broad requirements for agency heads to establish and maintain comprehensive occupational safety and health programs. As part of their programs, qualified safety and health inspectors must inspect and identify hazards in the workplace and investigate accidents and employee complaints. Based on findings from investigations, agencies establish engineering and work practice controls and, where necessary, provide respiratory protection and personal protective equipment, as well as training on the use of respirators and how to get the respirator fit tested and to wear it properly, when to wear personal protective equipment, how to properly put on and take off personal protective equipment. OSHA also performs inspections of federal agency workplaces, enforces standards in a manner that is similar to the approach existing in the private sector, but federal agencies are not penalized for noncompliance. As part of the 2009 H1N1 outbreak, OSHA has been fully engaged in federal coordination on issues related to worker protections. OSHA is providing technical assistance to our federal partners on general and agency-specific issues related to the health and safety of their staffs. I am confident that the numerous exercises we have carried out in emergency planning at both federal and local levels since 2001 will pay off in our ability to work together in combating this threat to the workplace. Mr. Chairman, I would characterize this situation for the federal workforce just as the President has described it for the nation: cause for deep concern, but not panic. I'm very confident in the expertise of OSHA's medical, scientific, compliance assistance, and enforcement personnel. OSHA is prepared to address this threat and will protect our workforce. I will keep you informed about OSHA's efforts to protect America's federal employees from the current 2009 H1N1 virus and from pandemic flu exposure. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Weissman. You have 5 minutes. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chairman Lynch and Ranking Member Chaffetz, and other distinguished members of the subcommittee. I'm Dr. David Weissman, Director of the Division of Respiratory Disease Studies at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. I genuinely appreciate this opportunity to speak to you today and update you on the current efforts that CDC is taking to respond to the 2009 H1N1 influenza outbreak. Providing frequent and informative communications about the outbreak is an important CDC priority. NASH is proud to be part of an aggressive response by CDC to understand the outbreak and to implement effective control measures. It's important to note that our nation's current preparedness is the direct result of investments and support by Congress for pandemic preparedness and the hard work of federal, state, and local officials all across the country. The 2009 H1N1 influenza virus is contagious and spreads from human to human. It spreads in a similar way as seasonal influenza in that flu viruses are thought to spread mainly from person to person through coughing or sneezing by people with influenza. Sometimes people can get infected by touching something with flu viruses on it and then touching their mouth or nose or eyes. Surveillance has been ramped up around the country to try and get a better understanding of the magnitude of this outbreak, and we're actively tracking the progression of this virus globally. It's important that we continue to be vigilant. We need to be prepared for a possible return of this virus to the U.S. in the fall. CDC has and continues to develop specific recommendations for what individuals, communities, clinicians, and other professionals can do. Everybody has a role to play in limiting this outbreak. Individuals can take actions that will prevent respiratory infections. Frequent hand washing is something that we emphasize as an effective way to reduce transmission. Adults with flu-like illness should stay at home and not go to work. Children with flu-like illness should also stay home and not go to school or childcare. And if you're ill, you shouldn't get on an airplane or any public transport to travel. Taking personal responsibility for these things will help reduce the spread of this new virus as well as other respiratory illnesses. During public health emergencies like the current outbreak, protecting workers, including federal workers, is a top priority. Like all of us, workers can contract influenza through general community exposures, and some workers, especially healthcare workers and emergency responders, are at higher risk for infection because their jobs, by definition, bring them into repeated close contact with individuals who are ill with this virus. These workers represent a particularly high priority for prevention. NASH is leading a CDC team effort to minimize the effects of the outbreak on workers by developing and disseminating guidance on precautions to prevent transmission of the illness in the workplace. Our guidance is informed by the hierarchy of controls used to reduce exposure, including engineering controls like isolation, ventilation, and physical barriers, administrative and work practice controls like social distancing and telecommuting, hand hygiene, and cough etiquette, and personal protective equipment like gloves, glasses, gowns, and respiratory protective devices. As the outbreak evolves, specific guidance on the appropriate use of these controls is guided by our evolving understanding of the outbreak and the level of evidence supporting the effectiveness of the various controls. As part of the larger CDC response, we fielded questions and provided assistance to other federal agencies responding to this influenza outbreak. For example, soon after the start of the outbreak, the Department of Homeland Security contacted us, and we helped them develop infection control measures to protect their most at-risk employees. We've continued to be in communication with DHS as the outbreak has evolved. We've also provided guidance to the U.S. Postal Service, the Department of Defense, and the U.S. General Services Administration to help them protect their employees from the virus. As we learn more, CDC will evaluate its guidance and update it as appropriate, and will continue to work with other federal agencies to provide the best and most current possible guidance for federal workers. In closing, we're working hard to understand and control this outbreak and to keep the public and the Congress fully informed about the situation and our response. We're working in close collaboration with our federal partners, including our sister HHS agencies and other federal departments. Even if this outbreak proves to be less serious than we might have initially feared, we must anticipate the possibility of a subsequent or follow-on outbreak several months down the road. While we must remain vigilant, it's important to note that in no time in our nation's history have we been more prepared to face this kind of challenge. We look forward to working closely with you to address this evolving situation as we face the challenges in the weeks and months ahead. Thanks again for the opportunity to testify before you, and I'll be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you, Doctor. Ms. Kishak, welcome.
Thank you. Chairman Lynch, Ranking Member Chaffetz, and members of the subcommittee, thank you for including the Office of Personnel Management in your discussion of this important topic. I would like to share with you our efforts to ensure the federal government is prepared to meet the human resources management challenges posed by the recent H1N1 flu outbreak, as well as any future pandemic health crisis. Our essential function in this regard is to provide critical human resources services to ensure the federal government has the civilian workforce it needs to continue essential missions in an emergency. These include emergency staffing authorities, leave flexibilities, evacuation payments, telework, and flexible working arrangements. We are continuously preparing for an influenza pandemic by developing and updating comprehensive human resources guidance and conducting briefings for federal human resource specialists, as well as town hall meetings for employees at numerous federal agencies. It is not possible to overstate my concern and that of OPM Director John Barry, that we do everything necessary to protect the well-being of all federal employees. However, we at OPM do not have the expertise to make judgments about the efficacy and appropriateness of certain medications and protective devices to frontline workers. Therefore, we have tried to keep federal agencies apprised of the latest expert advice on these issues. For example, at the H1N1 Human Resources Readiness Forum we hosted last Friday, we made available representatives of the CDC, OSHA, and the Federal Occupation Health Service in the Department of Health and Human Services to answer questions about personal protective measures. The forum focused on pandemic influenza readiness for human resources directors, federal employee union leaders, and other interested parties. OPM and other panelists answered the questions that weigh most heavily on the minds of managers and employees when they think about how a pandemic health crisis will affect them. One tool that can be extremely useful in coping with a pandemic health crisis is telework. It can help mitigate the spread of influenza by promoting social distancing while allowing the critical work of the nation to continue. OPM Director John Barry recently announced a new initiative that we hope will help agencies ramp up their telework readiness. This initiative is driven not only by Director Barry's belief in the value of work-life programs generally, but more specifically in the importance of telework as a tool for emergency planning. Under the Director's telework initiative, we will convene an advisory group of telework program managers to formulate standards for agency telework policies, which we have asked agencies to submit to OPM for our review. Each agency has been asked to appoint a telework managing officer and to ensure their existing appeals process is transparent to employees. Finally, we will work with Congress to assure the provision of high-quality, broadly accessible telework training that will provide the baseline everyone needs to achieve success. With implementation of this initiative, we believe we will see not only an improvement in the consistency and quality of telework policies, but also an increase in participation in telework. Employees who telework regularly and effectively under normal circumstances are well positioned to continue to work from home during any type of emergency. Our pandemic planning provides that employees who are not currently teleworking certainly may be able to telework during an emergency. However, experienced teleworkers have the necessary equipment, commuter connectivity, and practice working from a remote location that will enable them to continue critical work during an emergency. The current outbreak reminds us we must always be prepared to take care of our employees while continuing to meet the needs of the nation. Federal agencies need to ensure their pandemic plans are up to date. They should make sure they have telework agreements with as many telework-eligible employees as possible and should test employees' eligibility to access agency networks from home as well as their procedures for communicating with employees who are teleworking. OPM stands ready to provide guidance and support. Thank you for inviting me here today, and I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you. Secretary Duke.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chairman Lynch, Ranking Member Chavez, and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to come here before you this afternoon and discuss how the Department of Homeland Security is preparing and protecting its employees in response to the 2009 H1N1 flu outbreak.
Mr. Chairman, could I just ask the witness to move that mic a little closer? Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Connolly. I recognize that, as a department, we must work together to take proper safety precautions to reduce transmission of any disease while still performing our critical mission. This may mean that some employees need to wear personal protective equipment. Some employees may need to telecommute. Others may need to stay home if they have illness in their family or if their child's school is closed. I am committed to working with the component heads throughout the department and across the federal government to provide our employees with the safest possible working environment. Our workforce's safety and security is always a top priority. It is important to know that we are making all of our decisions based on the science and epidemiology as recommended by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the workplace guidance from the Departments of Health and Human Services, the Department of Labor, Occupation, Self, and OSHA Office, the Public Health Community, and the World Health Organization. Planning for a pandemic has been ongoing for several years. In fiscal year 2006, the department was able to build the basis of its pandemic program. We began purchasing personal protective equipment for use by mission essential employees. Currently, personal protection equipment is pre-positioned at 53 DHS locations and field offices nationwide. The department has also stockpiled two types of antivirals, the trademarks Tamiflu and Relenza, dedicated for DHS workforce protection. DHS has on hand approximately 540,000 courses of antivirals targeted for its mission essential workforce. Guidance on the use of that antivirals has recently been published. Another element of planning the work was done in 2006 through several planning documents, including the DHS Pandemic Influenza Contingency Plan, publishing screening protocols for pandemic influenza in the air, land, and maritime environments, draft Federal Interagency Pandemic Influenza Strategic Plan, and the National Strategy for Pandemic Influenza Implementation Plan. And we have exercised these plans. In October 2008, DHS conducted an interdepartmental pandemic influenza tabletop exercise. The purpose of the workshop was to facilitate in-depth discussions and highlight potential actions addressing departmental workforce protection during the pandemic influenza event. All DHS components were represented, along with 13 other federal departments and agencies, with a total of 100 participants. Effective communication in any disaster is critical, and a severe pandemic where there would be nationwide consequences is no exception. DHS has made communication from the Secretary through the rest of leadership and through the components a top priority. Guidance was issued by headquarters officials and components advising our employees to follow procedures and recommendations of the CDC, and we have consulted with Department of Labor's OSHA's office regarding workforce protections. Training has also been crucial for preparing DHS workforce in the event of a pandemic. The Office of Health Affairs within DHS developed pandemic awareness training, and this is on DVD and available to all our DHS components. Additionally, some components, such as ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, have further developed training. The department is taking several steps to ensure continued responsiveness to the component's request and to ensure health and safety of our DHS workforce. Moving forward, one of our goals is to provide uniform occupational health services across the department in order to ensure operational components can deliver post-exposure prophylaxis and treatment of employees more effectively in the future. In addition, we hope to strengthen our internal medical oversight capacity, ensuring DHS fully utilizes the capabilities of our medical personnel in health affairs, as well as our emergency services medical personnel. Finally, our health affairs office has been developing a more formal mechanism for providing medical advice to DHS components. In conclusion, DHS remains dedicated to protecting the health and safety of our workforce in the event of a pandemic and during this recent H1N1 outbreak. I will continue to work closely with Secretary Napolitano and our component heads in response to the needs of the DHS employees throughout this outbreak and in the future. As I said, our workforce safety and security is a top priority. Thank you for holding this hearing and look forward to your questions.
Thank you. As is often the case in Congress, we're required to be in several hearings at one time, and the ranking member, Mr. Chaffetz, has asked to be excused so he can go into another hearing where he's also questioning some witnesses. Let me begin by saying thank you to all of you for your willingness to appear before the committee. Let me try to sort of collapse the issue, because the scope of proper protection for all federal employees may be a bit overbroad for this one hearing. I do have some major concerns with principally the 50,000 TSA workers who are responsible for protecting our country and our security in their own way, as well as I believe we have 40,000 Customs and Border Patrol officers. Just to give you a sort of a snapshot of what my concern focuses on, a full-time transportation security officer, or TSO, works an 8-hour shift. Individuals working the split shift have a 10-hour shift, 4 hours on, 2 hours off, 4 hours on. And depending on the size of the airport, a typical TSO would come into contact with anywhere between 500 and 2,000 individuals in one shift. Data for selected larger airports as well, for instance, at Miami International Airport, TSOs probably clear about 3,300 passengers per shift. At JFK, it's about 9,000 passengers that they come into contact with daily. And we're talking about wanding them, checking their bags, checking identification, basically hands-on, literally, so that they have physical contact with these individuals. 9,000 per checkpoint per shift, and at Chicago, that's in New York, and at Chicago O'Hare, it's between 9,000 and 12,000 per checkpoint per day. So you have a lot of hands-on contact by these folks. Customs and Border Patrol officers, those shifts are also 8 hours, although I know from talking with them they work a lot of overtime because of the demands of the job, which, you know, that can be a 12 or a 16-hour shift for those folks. And a typical, I'm talking about the average Customs and Border Patrol officer, would see between 1,000 and 2,000 travelers per shift. The situation we just have, and I don't want to do too much looking back, because I think, as all of you have noted, we're worried about the next iteration of this flu. And that could be in the coming fall or at some time in the future. But there are lessons to be learned by looking back. And I've received hundreds of phone calls as the chairman of this committee, and affidavits, letters, emails about the way our security personnel, you know, Customs and Border Patrol, and TSOs are being treated. And the plain fact of the matter is that there has been a concerted effort to deny these employees the right to have a mask, an N95 mask, to be more specific. But it boggles my mind, quite frankly, that there is no, DHS has not come up with a written guidance for addressing the issue of voluntarily wearing protective masks. Now, these folks, as I say, have high contact. You know, I got a lot of feedback from my folks on the Mexican border, and I have to have some empathy for their position. If you look at the numbers of H1N1 cases in the border states of Texas, Arizona and California, the incidence of swine flu in those states is probably 400% of what the national average is. So there's an issue here, and it's empirical, what we're seeing. So we've got an issue with the Mexican border, and a heightened concern and a heightened exposure for those folks. And I've got affidavits from a number of officers from Laredo to Otay checkpoint, where they were told to take that mask off. And, Madam Secretary, I just want to ask you, number one, why don't we have a written guidance from DHS regarding the voluntary use of masks? Why are your managers telling and officials telling folks to take those masks off when they on the ground feel that that's a necessary protection that they need? And I'd like to hear your response to that.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And we do at DHS agree that from each one of these instances, there's lessons learned. And we did issue the policy, as you know, about mandatory use, which comes into the high-risk category under the OSHA prescription.
Let me just interrupt you, because I don't want you just blowing through there. That's an issue. That's a guidance for mandatory use of masks. And what you say in your guidance is that when an officer specifically knows or suspects that an individual has swine flu or is ill, then they're supposed to put on the mask if they're within 6 feet of that person. The problem here, as you probably can guess, is that there's a 7-day incubation period, number one. Number two, you've got to get close enough to these folks to do your job anyway, so you're already inside 6 feet. And as smart and as capable as my Customs and Border Patrol and my TSOs are, none of them are docs. And so they're going to have to make a determination that this person is ill. And so that guidance on mandatory mask wearing is virtually useless to someone on the ground doing this work. And again, I asked you about the guidance on when an officer or an agent may decide or may be allowed to use a mask, because I see nothing on that. So if you could address that point.
Yes. We looked at the category of potentially medium-risk employees, which would indicate a voluntary use of masks. We followed the medical evidence given to us by CDC's review of the H1N1 virus. And based on the medical evidence, we determined that there was not a need for a policy at this time. And it's something we continue to look at each day as the statistics and the data for this round of H1N1 proceed and the potential next round in the fall, as you say.
Well, wait a minute. You're telling people if you know or suspect specifically that an individual person has H1N1 or is ill, to wear the mask.
Yes.
Yeah. And you're saying that apart from that determination, that a person doesn't have the right to use the masks.
There is not medical indication that it would be appropriate to wear the mask in the workplace based on the job requirements, the way H1N1 has progressed through the population in this first phase.
You got to do this before the fact, though. You're saying now that it's progressed, you don't warrant it. It just doesn't hold water. That whole argument. You're telling people, wash your hands, cover your mouth when you cough, stay home when you're sick. But these folks are on the front lines. You don't think this is a high-risk situation when you have these folks screening, hundreds if not thousands of travelers coming in from, in this case, Mexico, where we had a very high number of cases already reported?
I think it's critical, and we heard what our employees said. and we will continue to evaluate it, but based on to really warrant wearing masks in the workplace, there has to be a high reasonable probability that the employees are going to encounter the sicknesses in their line of duty. And based on the medical evidence, I know I've said that before, but I have to keep going back to it. We consulted with the experts, and it did not seem appropriate. Wearing masks is not a neutral physical condition. There are risks with it. With certain populations and wearing the respirators. Additionally, there are other personal protection and equipment, such as the frequent washing of hands, the social distancing when you.
Well, these workers weren't even allowed to use sanitizer, and I'm not apart from the masks. They also report that they weren't allowed a chance to go wash their hands or use sanitizer. They were kept on the line. They weren't allowed to have breaks, so they weren't allowed to, you know. So here you got somebody who's checking maybe thousands of people. I'd hate to be the thousandth person in line after this person has already, you know, wanded and checked 1,000 people coming through from Mexico, and this whole volume of people is continually coming through, and this person is not allowed to disinfect from one shift to another. That troubles me greatly.
My understanding is that TSA did change protocols on the cleansing of bins, but I will check into that, Mr. Chairman.
I'm going to let Mr. Conley say a few things. We're going to come back to this again. Look, I'm not satisfied with your answer. I'm not satisfied with the policy that DHS was adopted for their employees. I think the decision should be made on the ground. And your guidances have been totally non-responsive to this situation of voluntary use of masks where these individuals feel they need to. And I'm receiving nothing here. You're going to continue to reevaluate?
Absolutely.
That's not good enough. That's not good enough. We'll legislate. If that's what I got to do to get the permission for my federal workers to wear masks on the Mexican border in the middle of an epidemic, a pandemic, or the threat of one, if I got to legislate that they have the right to wear masks to protect themselves and their families and their communities, that's what we'll do. But I shouldn't have to do that. I shouldn't have to blow up the bureaucracy just to get something done. This is a simple issue. This is a really simple issue. Protect these workers. They're protecting us. They're screening thousands of people coming in. If they're infected, what about the exposure of those other passengers? What about the exposure of their families? What about the exposure to their kids? What about the exposure to the towns in which they live? You know, and you look at the numbers in Texas, Arizona, and California, and like I say, they're 4 times the national average. It's not an immigration thing. It's just a common sense thing that we're trying to protect these workers. And I find your response and the position of DHS unacceptable. Just doesn't work. Your excuses are lame, and you're saying that you're following the medical evidence. This is common sense. This is common sense. It's not, you know, in my prior job, I used to have to wear a respirator as a welder. It's not a comfortable thing. It's not something that someone's going to leap to do. If they feel it's necessary, they will put the mask on. It's hot. It's stuffy. It's not something that people enjoy doing. So there's almost an inclination that people won't wear them. But when these workers feel that they're at risk and they need that protection, well, we ought to provide that. We're supposed to be an example, the power of example, the federal government as an employer. These are very brave people. These are good people. These are hard workers. And, we should be taking care of them the way they're taking care of the American people. And I don't think that's being done right now. I really don't. And I think this bureaucracy, this back and forth about agency, they said this, Forget that stuff. Let's just get it done. Let's get these masks to the employees. Let them use it when they deem it necessary. Let them protect themselves. And let's move on. The ranking member is back, so Mr. Conley, I'm going to defer. Mr. Chaffetz, you're recognized for 5 minutes.
Thanks, Mr. Conley. Appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Actually, is whatever time you may consume, I overwent my 5 minutes while you were gone.
I'll be brief, and my apologies for missing the first portion. I had a similar hearing next door, and I appreciate your understanding that. My questions are for you, Ms. Duke, because I concur with the chairman here on this. This is not acceptable. You said in your testimony that safety is your top priority. Do you believe that the actions of the Department of Homeland Security are consistent with that testimony that you gave?
I do believe that as we took our actions, we had the safety of our
what
employees.
What is the policy? What should have happened? And what versus what happened? I mean, why weren't they allowed to wear masks if they so choose? I mean, we're in a medical emergency, right? Or were we not?
Yes, we were.
What is the written standard? What is the policy? What should have happened per the guidebook? Is the guidebook wrong?
By the guidebook, I'll take that as meaning the OSHA policy. We're supposed to analyze the risk of employees, and based on the categorization of the risks to the employees, based on the threat, their work situation, either prescribe mandatory usage, voluntary usage, or it's a mask.
So are you saying that at that stage, that had not kicked into the voluntary, it was voluntary compliance was or voluntary use of the mask would not have kicked in at that stage?
We discussed voluntary usage of the mask. The H1N1.
Who made the decision not to allow that to happen? And what was the underlying reason that they weren't allowed to?
The underlying reason was when we consulted with the medical experts within the federal government, including CDC, that it was not warranted nor necessary.
So it wasn't warranted or necessary. And who made that ultimate determination?
I would have to say the Secretary of Homeland Security.
Now, you said this is based on science, but everything I've read and heard said this is based on proximity and that there needs to be a certain amount of distance and that by, you know, ultimately touching or coming in contact and all of that. I just find it absolutely astronomical or just unacceptable that our federal workers were not allowed, if they so choose, to don things that would protect them for the very the world is looking at this as a pandemic. We look at the possibility of this sweating moving northward, I just am dumbfounded that the Department of Homeland Security would not take and put, as you say, safety as its top priority. I find nothing in the evidence to suggest that this was the right move. If that the written policies need adjustment, I would hope that you would return to this committee and that the Homeland Security would return to this committee and demonstrate that truly safety is the top priority, because I see nothing that would exemplify that. I think this is also something that we should note in terms of culturally. You know, I spent quite a bit of time in my career in Asia. It's commonplace. If you have a cold or you're somewhat sick, you wear a mask, and nobody thinks a second of it. Maybe a Westerner who's been there for the first time, I remember the first time I saw it, but people become very accustomed to it. I find a great discrepancy between your insistence that safety is the top priority and then what we went through and are going through at the border and with our TSA employees and a host of other federal workers who go through this. I just find it totally unacceptable. I concur with the chairman here. I just want to ask one other thing of Ms. Pardon me for how you pronounce your name, but
Kaichek.
What sort of drills or what sort of training or what sort of preparation is there that actually happens for these types of things? And specifically as it relates to the whole telecommuting, because we could have very quickly had to get into a scenario as it relates to telecommuting, and I just wonder how well we would be prepared in order to execute on that.
Well, each agency has been encouraged, and as I said, we've done
if you
we've
can,
done
sorry,
a lot
just
of,
the microphone there a little bit. Thank you.
Each agency is encouraged to practice, and we've done town halls suggesting this. I know OPM has run several drills where we have sent a good segment of our workforce home, and those are not people who normally telework, but we have sent them home to try to work for 3 or 4 days. We want to see what it's like for more than just an afternoon to try to get your work done so that people get a sense of what it's like. And so that's the kind of drilling
we've
done.
How prepared are we for that? If 0 is nothing and 100 is perfect, where are we on that scale?
As far as practicing telework is concerned, based on the low numbers of teleworkers today, I would put us on a 4.
Out of 100?
No, out of 10. I'm sorry.
Maybe 40?
Yeah. Okay. Yes, I think one thing that we're learning is that you have to practice and then practice and then practice because your connectivity changes. You know, you do it, and 6 months later, it's out of date, and you have to do it again. So we
would
have
McCulloch
to keep at
yield.
That.
Thank you. Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Would McCulloch yield?
Sure.
I just want to... Ms. Kutchuk, you gave it a 4 out of 10. What percentage of the federal workforce currently teleworks?
6%.
6%.
On a routine basis.
So 40% is really grading on the curve.
Right. At this point, the chair would like to recognize the gentleman from Virginia, Mr. Connolly, for 5 minutes.
Thank the chair. Ms. Duke, if I could go back to you just for a minute, because I want to follow up on the comments of the chairman and the ranking member, and I associate myself with them. I guess the problem I have, and I suspect my colleagues do as well, is you keep on harping back to there is no medical evidence that would justify the use, the voluntary use or mandatory use of masks, which that statement would imply there is some medical threshold by which you measure, you know, that would kick in the use of masks. And I guess I'd like to know what that medical threshold is, if there is such a medical threshold in DHS's mind. And I guess from our point of view, and the chairman used the phrase common sense, you've got to differentiate, it seems to me, the nature of the job. If I'm a transit operator behind a glass panel and I never have human contact during the course of my 8-hour work day, that's one thing. On the other hand, as the chairman indicated, if you're a TSA worker, you're patting people down. Increasingly, you're engaged in near-strip searches. You're exposed to all kinds of things. You're dealing with hundreds of people. And let's say you're in El Paso, and you're dealing with a lot of Mexican travelers, and the epicenter of this epidemic was in Mexico. Why wouldn't we, just as a matter of prudent and reasonable prophylaxis, say to those workers, if you feel more comfortable wearing a mask, guidance is, have at it. You don't want to, you don't have to, we're not in a mandatory mode, but if that makes you feel safer and gives you a comfort level coming to work and a comfort level extended to your family, why in the world wouldn't we encourage that or allow that?
Mr. Connolly, a couple parts to your question. First of all, on the mandatory use, the standard for that is that an employee is in the high risk, and that's a known or probable case. So if, for instance, a Border Patrol agent believes that a traveler is exhibiting symptoms and they decide they're going to refer the case, call in CDC, then that would fit in as an example of fitting into the high risk category. DHS has not issued, just to clarify maybe my previous answers, we have not issued a policy to prohibit the use of masks at the department level. What we have relied on during this first phase of the epidemic is individual judgments based on the specific scenario, and so there was not a prohibition at the department level of wearing of masks.
Mr. If I may interrupt you there. That is contradictory to the evidence presented to this committee. We're hearing from the workforce that quite the opposite, that as a matter of fact, there is a general broad prohibition against voluntary use of the mask, that they are not permitted to do it, specifically at DHS.
We have not, I know emphatically, and I will check throughout the components, that we have not issued any guidance that prohibits the use of masks.
Well, that's good to know, Mr. Chairman, and I'm sure it will come as a relief to the workforce.
Let me follow up on Mr. Connolly's question. You have given permission to Customs and Border Patrol agents, not officers, to wear the masks. They all wear the masks. Voluntarily. I'm sorry, Border Patrol. So those agents, those Border Patrol agents, under the instruction of your managers, your officers, they're all allowed to use the mask voluntarily, and they do, and they do. So, so you see what I'm saying? Your own policy for them is wear the masks, and yeah. And they're not, and that's not that that's completely voluntary for them. And they don't have any, let's say, medical or clinical distinction from the exposure being experienced by the other officers as well. And it's just, so you've got some great inconsistency here. I also want to just share, you know, I've got a bunch of these affidavits that have come in from different officers all over the country. This is one case. This is a Kenneth Egan. And he actually took this serious enough to file an affidavit, a sworn statement, under the penalties, pains and penalty of perjury. And he says, I'm employed by the U.S. Bureau of Customs and Border Protection. I am currently assigned to Las Vegas Port of Entry and Airport. On Monday, and he says, my assigned duties include processing inbound passengers, and I regularly come into contact with members of the traveling public arriving from Mexico. And those contacts routinely require contact within 6 feet of those individuals. He goes on to say that on Monday, April 27th, this is right around the time that this first became apparent. I think it was the 22nd. So this is 5 days into the crisis. I was scheduled to work primary inspection booth 8 from 9:30 to 5:30. After I set up in the booth, I began processing passengers. I put on my protective gloves and the N95 mask. I have a, this is what an N95 mask, not anywhere as fearsome as the mask I used to wear as a welder. This is like a little dust mask. I don't know how that would alarm the public. Anyway, he said, I donned my gloves and my N95 mask. The first two flights of the day were from Mexico, and one was from Mexico City, which is the epicenter of the swine flu outbreak. During the second flight, Mexicana Flight 996 arrived from Mexico City. Chief Gonzalez, his superior, came to his assigned booth and blocked the aisle so no new passengers could approach. The other supervisor, Mr. Campbell, blocked the booth door behind him. I was processing a passenger at the time, and Chief Gonzalez interrupted the inspection, ordered me to remove the mask. He said, take the mask off now. You are not authorized to wear a mask. He goes on to say, I finished the processing of the passenger and removed the nitrile gloves, used hand sanitizer to clean his hands, and then removed the N95 mask. He said, after I removed the mask, Chief Gonzalez told me not to wear a mask while processing passengers. He told me that the only time I could wear a mask was if the person standing in front of me was showing obvious signs of the flu, as had been explained in a muster briefing. He said, I told Chief Gonzalez that if I waited for someone to hack or cough on me, it would be too late for the mask to provide protection against exposure. I've got a lot of these. This is from Lilia Pineda, who's also a U.S. Border and Customs Patrol Protection Department of Homeland Security, San Diego. Her assignments, again, were processing inbound passengers, vehicles, and pedestrians. So this is a land checkpoint.
The largest land checkpoint in the world.
There you go. On or about April 28, 2009, Lilia Pineda was working at Otay Mesa, Primary Lane 4, and decided to wear an N95 respirator mask. I had made this decision for several reasons. I had been fitted for an N95 respiratory mask. I had also been trained to fit other Customs and Border Patrol officers for that mask. I was encountering individuals who were coming in from Mexico City and other cities in central Mexico where the swine flu was prevalent. I also had a cold at the time, and thought I was especially vulnerable to getting another illness. I was also concerned about exposing other members of my family. At approximately 9:30, while wearing an N95 respirator mask while working, I was approached by Chief Kate, who instructed me to remove my mask. I explained to him that I had taken the training for the respirator fit test trainer, and that I felt it was a health and safety issue for me to wear the mask that I had been fitted for. And despite my objection, the chief refused to allow me to wear the mask. He repeatedly asked me angrily with his hands at his hips, saying, "Are you going to comply or do you want to go home sick?" There are, you know, there are a lot of these affidavits that clearly indicate from various parts of the country that there's a concerted effort on the part of DHS not to let these employees wear the masks. And while you say that you don't have any policy that says you can't wear masks, your people on the ground, your managers, the people who work for you, are telling these workers they can't use the mask. So, I mean, what do you say to that? And it's all around the country, so it's not an isolated case.
What I would say to that is that during the first round of H1N1, we did, consistent with OSHA, and I'm going to explain, allow decisions to be made by individual supervisors based on their assessment of risk. What we heard back from the employees is that created at least a perception of inconsistency without DHS. Mr. Chairman, you mentioned some people were wearing masks, so the inconsistency. So what we're looking at right now is, should that practice continue? Should it be individual site-specific first-line supervisor discretion, or especially if there's another round of H1N1 in the fall, should we look at risks from the department and ensure consistency in our workforce?
That's too late as far as I'm concerned. I'm going to yield 5 minutes to Mr. Bilbray from California.
Mr. Yeah. Chairman, I hadn't quite finished my last
question. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Please.
And I know we have to vote. If Mr. Bilbray would indulge me, just on one
sure,
item.
Go right ahead.
And I just wanted to say, Mr. Chairman, and I certainly associate myself with your remarks, I was very heartened by Ms. Kitchak's comments on telework, and I was very impressed with Mr. Berry's. We had a press conference up here, and he was kind enough to invite several of us who have introduced legislation, H.R. 1722, to promote telework in the federal government. And I really, it's nice to have a partnership mm-hmm. on this subject. But I think telework, Mr. Chairman, is essential to any kind of continuity of operations plan in the federal government. In fact, it's essential for the private sector as well. And, Mr. Chairman, I would ask that at some point this subcommittee may want to consider hearings and a markup of H.R. 1722, so that we can help codify progress within the federal ranks to ensure that telework is formally an option for our federal workforce. I thank the chair.
I thank the gentleman. Chair now recognizes Mr. Bill Bray from California for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Duke, I was in local government long enough to know when I hear somebody wordsmithing. It's not an official policy of the department, but it was an open opportunity for local supervisors to deny the employee the free choice to wear this or not. Is that a fair explanation of your term? There's no policy, department policy against it?
I guess I not sure by free choice. I mean, the employer has to manage the workplace and determine if it's appropriate. So in this case, we did exercise that free choice. We did exercise discretion in managing the workplace, and some employees were not allowed to wear their masks in the workplace. We learned over the last 2 weeks, yes.
My question to you, are you aware of any more exposure that somebody at the land entries would have as opposed to somebody at the airport entries?
Well, the evidence indicates that we have very few instances of DHS employees just in general having confirmed cases of the H1N1.
Okay. For the record, Mr. Chairman, I just think that it's essential that those of us along the frontera point out that unlike the airports, people do not fly into the United States specifically to get free medical care. But one of the realities of the federal mandate of free medical care in this country is that people that are outside the country that want to receive free medical care along the frontera just have to get in their car and drive across the border and present themselves with their illness. And one of the issues that have not been discussed is the increased exposure of our men and women at the land port of entries because of the attractive nuisance of, or the situation of, actually encouraging people to come into the United States who are showing symptoms because they can get treated for free in the United States. And so the men and women along our port of entries are exposed that much more than not only the general public, but also even their, more than their colleagues that would be handling flights coming in to an airport. And I want to make that clear so that we understand what kind of situations are along the border. Now, the issue of the primary and secondary, were the secondary people allowed to wear masks at a time that the primary was denied?
I know of no such policy.
Okay, I was informed there was. Anybody got any? You know, the discussion, I have to say, do you want a six-foot, the six-foot barrier kind of thing reminds me of some kind of dancing rule in our cabaret licenses in government. My question to you, the procedure that somebody in primary at a land entry have, do you aware of the procedure that they would go? Anybody wants to talk about that? But the 6 foot to me sounds absolutely absurd. As somebody who grew up crossing that border, the primary inspector is at a window. He asks, specifically makes contact with the driver, then proceeds to make contact with every member in that vehicle, which usually means placing his or her head into the vehicle to be able to hold that conversation. To even discuss the 6 foot for primary is absolutely absurd. We're talking face-to-face discussions going on, and then for a 6 foot issue to come up, do you have any explanation of how anyone in primary could operate their duty and still maintain a 6 foot barrier between them and the individuals making contact with?
No, I believe most primary screening would be within 6 feet at a land port of entry.
Okay. What is the department doing today? And I apologize for being here late, but I've had another hearing and bouncing back and forth. What have we done today to make it clear, or has the policy been changed to allow the men and women that are on the front line to make this determination themselves, or is it still a supervisor by supervisor's call like it was in the last month?
The current state of H1N1, even CDC has changed their guidance on May 8th, does not warrant the use of respirators, the N95, even in the conditions that we're discussing here. So the medium risk, which is within the general public, recurring for long periods of time, does not warrant the use of masks, according to the CDC guidance.
So today, if somebody in San Ysidro wanted to put on a mask in primary, they can't do it?
The supervisor would assess the specifics of the situation. Some employees do wear masks and are permitted to by the supervisor.
You know, let me just be very frank about this. I have seen the public relations game played along the border for 30 years. This certainly looks to me more like a PR concern than a public health concern. And I operated a public health department for 3 million people for 10 years. And there's no way in the world I could have asked my county or city employees not to be given the ability to make that call. I mean, there is that issue of free choice when it comes to your health. This is one that I just think goes way over. And I'm sorry, I know you're having to carry quite a burden walking in this room. But frankly, I think this is an indictment on the system that they worry about perceptions more than allowing people to make that choice themselves to protect their health. And I just think that it is going to be one that's not going to be let up until it's corrected. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And just I'm not going to beat this to death, but in the one breath you say CDC says it's not warranted, the masks aren't warranted. But in the next breath, you've got all your your Border Patrol agents all wearing them voluntarily. So you're not relying on CDC because all those folks can wear the masks. But you got 50,000 others that can't wear the masks. and you've got whatever medical evidence you've got, but you've made two different decisions where there really isn't a distinction between the jobs being done by those officers. So you're not relying on CDC. I know you're trying to shift the responsibility to them, but you've already taken it upon yourself to make a dual policy between border agents and TSOs and, you know, customs folks. So and ICE, those employees as well, who are not being allowed to wear the masks. It's an internal inconsistency that you got within your own department. Let me ask, I'm going to have to break for votes here shortly, but Dr. Wiseman, while I recognize that NIOSH is not responsible for setting standards, I understand that NIOSH has taken a lead role in pandemic flu research and personal protective gear. Do you feel, and I'm not sure if you can answer this, but do you feel that an airborne transmissible disease standard should be considered by OSHA? And is this one of those areas where NIOSH thinks it might be warranted?
I think that's a policy issue that obviously I wouldn't make, you know, on my own. But I think that we have guidance and the question of whether it's done in a regulatory way or it's done, you know, in a non-regulatory way, as long as it happens, as long as people do the right thing. And in the case of flu, you know, as long as people do, you know, not only respiratory protection but do the whole range of protections, you know, is what's really important. So let's not lose track of the fact, you know, that people need to do the range of other things that we've talked about. You know, people have to wash their hands. You know,
right.
People, you have to do the distancing and the etiquette and the contact and all those kinds of things too. And whatever happens, whatever comes down the road, you know, should take into account the full range of the hierarchy of controls. So I guess that would be my response. I wouldn't focus just on respiratory.
I understand that. I certainly value your opinion. On that point, though, in a lot of these cases, these transportation security officers were not allowed to wash their hands, not allowed to use sanitizer in the process of screening these passengers. Is there anything that you could think of that would warrant refusing them permission to do that?
Well, you know, we didn't talk with specifically with DHS about this. The one anecdote that I can give you where this issue did come up was with the Postal Service, where the Postal Service has a history since the attacks of since the anthrax attacks of 2001 of allowing its employees to use N95 filtering face piece respirators on a voluntary basis. And when the 2009 H1N1 outbreak occurred, they contacted us with the question of, well, should we, would it be all right if we allowed them voluntary use of N95s or surgical face masks? And our response back to them was that it was really important, if that were done, to do it within the context of an educational program to make clear that just if people use those devices, that they should also follow the other, you know, protections, you know, the other things that we've talked about. Again, hand washing, distancing to the possible, to the extent possible, you know, barriers, and also understanding, you know, the strengths and limitations of the devices. So that was that's the one anecdote I can give you of where that came up.
Okay. I am going to have to run over and vote. How many votes? Three? Okay, so I should be back in about 25 minutes. Thank you.